Her father relented, if only because he likely knew she wouldn't stop asking questions until he did. "There has been no firm evidence that the South is planning an attack," he said. "Yet we will remain vigilant." To Gwen's ears, it sounded like a planned answer, with no real meat behind it. He might not be willing to be honest with her, but she was done hiding from him. If she wanted him to treat her like more than a child, she needed to stop sneaking around with her paramour. It was time to stab him with the truth, and see whether it was a flesh wound or a mortal blow. "I have something to—" she started to say, but just then the rest of the company arrived. There were several other Aurians, both men and women, their vibrant orange, gold, purple, and pink eyes giving away their heritage. There were also several humans, and Gwen was surprised to see Alistair's father, Levi, amongst the scouting party. It was strange because he was no scout. Gwen had never been formally introduced to Levi, but she'd seen Alistair with him on numerous occasions. He was a handsome man, his dark beard slightly longer than usual due to days of travel. Alistair, with his razor-sharp brows and dark eyes, was clearly his father's son, which wasn't a bad thing at all from Gwen's perspective. "Levi," Baroness said, "come meet my daughter, Gwenny." Gwenny, always Gwenny, she thought, even though she'd asked him to call her Gwen a dozen times. Regardless, the introduction surprised her, especially because she knew the two men didn't see eye to eye on most things. She bowed to Levi formally, in the manner of her people, and said, "May this be the first of many meetings." It was the traditional first greeting, and she was pleased to discover he knew the proper response. "May Orion shine on our friendship." Though many of the humans had either willingly or grudgingly adopted the Aurian traditions, there were plenty who hadn't, a cause of occasional strife within Feria. "Well met," her father said, in appreciation of them both. "Gwenny, Levi is a captain," she said. When she saw her father's eyebrows flare upward in surprise, she added, "I've seen him sally out from Ironwood with his platoon. Eastern Seaboard Patrol, if I'm not mistaken." Baroness laughed. "As you can see, Captain Freestep, my daughter takes far too much interest in the business of war." "We all have a responsibility to protect our land," Gwen said. "Hmm," her father mused, not sounding convinced. "Now, Gwenny, was there something you were going to tell me?" "Oh." He'd noticed her unease earlier. She wanted to tell him, but hadn't expected an audience. Especially not Alistair's father. Yet there was nothing for it. "Rip it off quick," she thought, like a bandage stuck to the skin with clotted blood. "Yes," she said. "I wanted you to know that I've met someone." Her father's eyes widened in mock surprise. "Oh? Someone special? Who, pray tell, is this lucky Aurian lad?" "Like a bandage," she reminded herself. "He's not Aurian," she said. Baroness Storm's eyes narrowed. Then he seemed to share a look with Levi, whose lips were pulled into a tight line. "The situation is even worse than I thought." She'd always believed her father would be the problem, but what if both fathers opposed them? "Choose your next words carefully, daughter," her father said. She jutted out her chin defiantly. "Father, I cannot choose my words any more than I can choose the yearnings of my heart. Both my words and my heart have made their own choices. And I've chosen this very man's son, Alistair Freestep. Oppose me if you will, but you cannot stop us." "Can we not?" Her father stepped forward, his violet eyes flashing. Suddenly, she felt less confident. And then Levi Freestep's lips quirked up, and a chuckle escaped the back of his throat. He tried to disguise it as a cough, but it was too late. Her own father's stern expression melted into a broad smile as he laughed. He wrapped Gwen up in an embrace, kissing her forehead. "I will not oppose you, nor your heart," he said. Gwen pulled back and stared at him. Was this really happening? Could she have so poorly misjudged her father's reaction? Had she agonized over this moment for no reason? "You will give your blessing?" Her father's eyes twinkled like twin fields of dew-covered lavender in the morning sun. "I already have," he said. Levi stepped forward and slapped him on the back like they were old friends. Both men looked past her. Shaking her head in wonderment at this unexpected turn of events, Gwen twisted her neck to see what had caught their attention. Her heart stopped. There, standing just beyond the edge of the forest, was Alistair. He wore his green Legionnaire's uniform, complete with shiny silver buttons and the Eastern sigil, twin swords crossed over a field of black. His long dark hair was combed back, tucked behind his ears. He'd freshly shaved the shadow from his cheeks. His lips curled into a dazzling smile, brighter than the noonday sun. His stormy eyes radiated determination, and, to her delight, a sliver of anxiety. He strode forward, step by step, his eyes tethered to hers. When he reached her, he raised a hand to her chin and gently pushed it up, closing her mouth. She hadn't even realized her lips had fallen open. Then he dropped his hand, holding it palm upwards.
"Oh, Orion, am I dreaming?" Gwen thought. "Is this real?"
It was an offer, in the Orion tradition.
"Take my hand, and take me."
It was an offer to bond. She took his hand, her palm pressing against his, their fingers threading together. Then she made her own offer, extending her opposite hand in the same manner. Alistair didn't hesitate, grasping her hand and accepting her for his bondmate. And then he kissed her. Their promise had been made, and Gwendolyn hadn't even had to sacrifice her father's love. A week later, Gwendolyn Storm still couldn't believe that Alistair Freestep had been so bold as to ask her father for his blessing to bond with her.
"And he did it before my father had departed for the South," Gwen marvelled.
Unexpectedly, Baroness Storm's scouting company had crossed paths with Captain Freestep's platoon. The two men had shared a laugh and struck up a warm friendship based on their children's budding relationship. Evidently, once their preconceived notions of each other had been struck down, they had more in common than they thought. How it had been kept secret from her, Gwen had no idea. Perhaps she was so love-struck that she'd been blind to the deceit.
"No," she thought. "Alistair's fear of my father had been well put on.
He was a talented actor, nearly as talented as he was a poet. She would get him back one day." Regardless, as she prepared for their bonding ceremony, set to occur later that day, she couldn't be happier. Though she didn't have any sisters of her own, the other Orion maidens had descended on her in force, channeling the forest's ore deposits to manipulate her marriage armor to perfection. The symbolic armor wasn't meant for battle, and thus they had significant flexibility as to the design. They'd done a wonderful job, and Gwendolyn hoped Alistair would find her as alluring as ever. Sheathed firmly against her slender but muscular body, the armor revealed just the right amount of skin, the small of her back, her lithe shoulders, the hollow in her neck that Alistair liked to kiss so much. The design was finished with a thin metallic band that wrapped around her head, studded with a clear, multifaceted gemstone. Sprigs of lavender were tied amongst the braids in her long, silver hair. Her father came to see her when she was ready. He held both her shoulders, shaking his head.
"You are a sight," he said.
"Your mother would have loved to see you like this. So happy." Gwendolyn's eyes blurred with unshed tears.
"I miss her," she said.
Her mother had been 50 years older than her father. She was taken far too soon, having lived for only a century and a half, passing on when Gwendolyn was just a little girl and her father barely older than a century.
"So do I," her father said.
"But she smiles upon this day from the great forest of Orion."
"I know."
She blinked away the tears and smiled. Cupping a hand to her father's face, she said,
"I never thought you would give your blessing for us."
"This again," her father said, but his tone held no anger. His eyes twinkled. She'd asked him half a dozen times what Alistair had said to gain his support, but her father refused to tell. Alistair was no more helpful, saying only,
"That's between your father and me." Gwen knew she shouldn't dwell on it, but the curiosity was eating her alive.
"Please tell me," she implored him. "This is my bonding day wish."
Her father laughed.
"You don't always fight fair, you know that."
Gwen shrugged.
"Not when I want something."
He grasped her hand.
"I see so much of your mother in you. I could never resist her, either. So you'll tell me?"
"Maybe later," he said. "The sun is stretching for the horizon. It is time."
It was the most beautiful bonding Gwen could have imagined. As she stood on the iron platform that stretched over the forest floor, she took in everything, memorizing every detail. The shiny ore sculptures set amongst the Orion and human guests, depicting prowling cats and soaring hawks and proud legionnaires. The flower petals sprinkled on every surface, pink and purple and orange and blue. The line of legionnaires, Alistair's fellow soldiers in training, encircling the entire ceremony, their dress armor gleaming in the last rays of sunlight. Hers and Alistair's father's, garbed all in white, standing side by side, proud as ever. She even saw Sasha the Orcat stalking through the woods, watching with shining silver eyes. And finally, Alistair, wearing ornamental armor that sleekly accentuated his strong arms, his broad shoulders, his muscular chest and abdomen. He ascended the iron steps to where she stood. His eyes roved over her body, lingering on the bared skin before meeting her gaze. He took her hand, and she fought off the urge to kiss him before the ceremony had well and truly started.
"I have no words sufficient to describe you today," Alistair said. "We don't need words. Not anymore," Gwendolyn said.
One of Orion's humble servants, a woman named Arwen, who'd been a friend of the family for years, and something of a mother figure to Gwen as of late, stepped forward to officiate.
"We stand before our fellow Orions, our human allies, and the great Orion, to bond these two individuals together in this—"
She stopped suddenly, when a commotion arose from somewhere in the audience. Someone shouted for silence, and it sounded like the commanding voice of Gwen's father. The officiant began again.
"As I was saying, we are here to bond these two—"
Again there was a noise, and this time it was sustained, a palpable buzz running through the audience, like the current from a lightning-struck tree. All heads turned toward the sound, including Gwen's and Alistair's. Someone ran down the path. The path that led directly to the forest city, the stronghold of Faria. The runner was fleet of foot, and, based on the coppery tinge to her hair, clearly had significant Orion blood coursing through her veins. She was shouting something as she ran, her words garbled at first, but slowly taking shape.
"We're under attack! Faria is under attack!"
As if to emphasize the runner's warning, something shrieked from above, a dark, sinewy form blotting out the sun. Several people screamed in terror, and beneath the iron walkway, guests scattered like fallen leaves, seeking shelter amongst the enormous trees. The circle of legionnaires broke, and they filled the pathway, charging for the city, to which their ultimate duty was bound. Next to Gwen, Alistair's body tensed, shocked by the sudden change in mood. Gwen, on the other hand, was made for intense situations like this one, her cheek burning with fire as her hero mark flared to life. Though her skin mark was strange to others, it had been a part of her from the day she was born, giving her a measure of strength, speed, and agility far superior to any human or Orion she'd ever met. And it was a good thing she didn't freeze up now, because the dragon dove with otherworldly speed and violence, spewing a gout of flames from a maw so large and black it could have been a cave. Gwen grabbed Alistair roughly and dove from the platform, hauling him behind her. She landed on her feet, cat-like, while Alistair grunted and rolled, his armor rattling. Their escape wasn't a moment too soon, either. She could feel the heat of the flames in their wake, enveloping the platform in a fiery inferno. Liquid ore splashed all around them, the metal instantly melted by the dragonfire. Several drips hit Gwen's exposed skin, burning her, and she wished she'd worn full armor rather than the impractical but gorgeous suit she was garbed in. A burning body collapsed nearby. Arwen, who would never get the chance to bond them. The realization hit Gwen like an arrow to the heart. Both of their fathers were by their sides in an instant, having fought through the crowd to get to them.
"Are you injured?"
Baroness Storm asked, clutching Gwen's arm. Somewhere above them, the dragon shrieked again. Gwen glanced up, but couldn't see the beast.
"No," she said. "I'm fine, too,"
Alistair echoed, though as they helped him to his feet, it was clear he was favouring his left foot.
"Find a place to hide," Levi Freestep said, a pained expression on his face. His command was unlawful, considering his own son was a legionnaire and duty-bound to defend the city to the death. He was allowing personal feelings to determine his actions in the midst of a battle.
"Yes," Gwen's father agreed. "Stay out of sight. The dragon cannot breach the deep parts of the forest." Evidently, the two fathers were in agreement. Their children's lives took precedent over any sense of duty. Gwen's father kissed her on the forehead and said,
"We have to go. Be safe."
The two men spun and ran down the path toward Feria. Alistair winced.
"You're not fine," Gwen said. "It could be worse."
Tears bit at Gwen's eyes, as his words rang true in the burning remains of the woman nearby. She'd known Arwen her entire life, and she'd been the closest thing to a mother Gwen had had since her real mother's death. She couldn't allow herself to dwell on the woman's death, however. Not now, not when danger was all around.
"We can make it to the trees," Alistair said,
even as the dragon shrieked and dove once more.
"Hurry!"
He tried to pull Gwendolyn along, but at that moment she saw a little boy, naught more than 7. He was stuck in the center of the clearing, having tripped while trying to make his escape. His parents were gone, perhaps assuming he was right behind them. He cried, his eyes wide with horror, staring at the monster swooping down from above. Her skin mark blazing with heat, Gwen ripped herself free of Alistair's grasp and charged for the boy, moving faster than humanly or Orionly possible. She could feel the dragon closing in, its wings buffeting her with displaced air. She scooped up the boy under one arm and dove, flames washing past her, as hot as a blacksmith's forge. As they rolled, she focused on protecting the boy, hugging him to her chest. When they came to a stop, she could see the ends of her silver hair sizzling and burning away. The boy's eyes were huge and wet, but he was unhurt. Above them, the dragon circled, its dark scales shimmering. On its back, Gwen could make out the shadowy silhouette of a rider, backlit by the sun. Thankfully, the clearing wasn't enough for it to land, and yet they were a long way from safety, and there could be other victims still in danger.
"Where is Alistair?"
she wondered. But she didn't have time to dwell on the question, because the dragon could strike again at any moment. Gwen fought to her feet and was about to carry the boy toward the forest when Sasha the Orcat appeared next to her, her head cocked to the side expectantly. Without words, Gwen knew exactly what the beast offered.
"Protect him with your life," she said,
and the cat bobbed her head in understanding. She placed the boy on Sasha's sleek back and helped him wrap his arms around her silver neck.
"Hold on tight," she instructed,
and the boy clasped his fingers. Then they were gone in a blur of awe, slipping into the forest. The dragon, or perhaps its rider, seemed to realize that most of their prey had moved on, and it veered off, a black spear rocketing back toward the city. The rest of the clearing was empty, save for several charred, smoking bodies and one other, who was limping toward her.
"Alistair, thank Orion."
Gwendolyn raced toward him, dropping down to help him out of his boot and inspect his leg.
"What are you doing?"
he asked.
"You need a healer," she said,
shocked by the amount of swelling.
"I need to get to Feria," he said. "I need to do my duty." "You're injured. Your father commanded you to seek shelter. Others will be worse off, and my father was wrong in his command. My duty lies with Feria."
His tone was resolute, and she realized he'd sounded the same way when he told her he loved her. Stalwart. Certain.
"We'll go together," she said.
She knew plenty of male Orions who would insist she, a young woman, remain behind. But Alistair wasn't like that. He'd never once tried to stifle Gwen's dreams of being a scout for the king, and never treated her like she was anything less than capable. He nodded, and they started down the path, avoiding puddles of liquid ore, the melted statues that were once so beautiful. Though Gwen had expected the attack on the city to be bad, nothing prepared her for the scene in front of her. Half a dozen dragons circled the walls of Haria, systematically diving and testing the kingdom's defences. Outside the castle, the half-metal, half-forest dwellings were destroyed, iron beams mangled and twisted, or simply melted down, tree trunks and branches charred and scorched. Hundreds, if not thousands, of bodies littered the straight, narrow streets. People wandered about, their eyes blank, searching for loved ones who were most likely already dead.
"Orion, save us all,"
Alistair breathed.
"It's too late for that,"
Gwen said. Bile threatened to creep up her throat and into her mouth. She swallowed it down. It was too late for the dead, but not the living. Avoiding the corpses, they wound their way toward the castle. When they reached the enormous iron gates, they found the thick doors torn from their hinges and discarded as easily as loose bark from the trunk of a tree. Inside the first ring in the multi-ringed castle, legionnaires fought Southroners. The enemy soldiers wore thick leather armor and were armed with whips and dual-edged blades, Calypsians. Using a strategy the Southerners were known for, they attempted to herd the legionnaires into flocks, which could then be attacked by dragon riders hoping to extinguish large chunks of Easterners. How they'd managed to attack without warning was a question that kept rattling around in Gwen's mind. The rumors of invasion were true, but hadn't come from Fanes as expected. Instead, it was the Calypsians. Alistair said, "Happy bonding day," and picked a sword from the ground. The previous owner wouldn't need it anymore, his eyes blank and staring. Gwendolyn said, "Fight with honor," and obtained her own weapon, a long metal bow and a satchel of arrows. As one, they joined the fray. Alistair may have been injured, but he was highly trained, and he likely had plenty of adrenaline to chase away the pain in his twisted ankle. Still, Gwendolyn kept an eye on him as he fought his way toward a platoon of men and women who found themselves backed against a wall. They were in danger of becoming dragon fodder if they didn't push their enemies back. Alistair managed to defeat two Calypsians before coming up against a determined trio with crackling whips. With their long-range weapons, they landed several blows, eventually forcing him to his knees. Gwen took aim as they closed in, three arrows simultaneously strung on her taut bowstring. Alistair raised his sword to defend against a potential killing blow that would never come. With a melodic twang, her arrows flew. Two easily passed Alistair on either side, finding their target's throats, while the third whizzed by his left ear and entered the third soldier's mouth, which was wide open with a snarl. His enemies collapsing before him, Alistair looked back and mouthed a silent, "Thank you," and then continued onward, uniting with the platoon. In the midst of allies, Gwen felt he would be safe, so she turned away, seeking others in need. As it turned out, she was the one in danger now. Several of the enemy had seen her triple arrow feet and raced toward her, leading with broad shields to protect themselves. Her hero mark burst to life once more. Shooting arrows straight and true was something she'd learned the hard way through countless hours of practice. But this next challenge required power beyond that of a mortal. Instead of running from her foes like they might expect, or trying to pierce their shields with her arrows, she wrenched two arrows from her satchel and charged them. Surprised, their pace slowed, but didn't stop. She reached the first enemy, a woman with silky black hair twisted into a braid and a black whip. The soldier swung the whip with a crack, but Gwen moved like lightning, dodging the blow, swerving around the woman's shield, and jamming the arrow through her leather armor and into her chest. Before the woman had fallen, Gwen was on to the next two enemies, a pair of men who seemed intent on using their shields as battering rams, coming at her from either side. This time she went airborne, leaping far higher than any normal Orion, much less human, could jump. Soaring over them, she kicked one in the face, while flinging an arrow into the other's eye. The remaining enemies fled, but she shot them in the backs, dropping each in turn. She felt no remorse, not after what had happened to Arwen and so many others. Despite her efforts, it wasn't nearly enough. The dragons wiped out entire platoons with their flames, while the foot soldiers continued to herd the remaining legionnaires deeper into the inner castle circles. Eventually they would run out of room to retreat and would be sitting ore monkeys. That's when reinforcements arrived, from both the air and the forest. Legionnaires riding ore hawks descended on the city, ripping holes in the clouds, attacking the exposed flanks of the dragons, sinking their talons into the riders, throwing them from their mounts. Like dead flies, they dropped from the sky, landing with screams and sickening thuds. The dragons fought back viciously, melting the skin of several orhawks and slapping them from the air with their spiked tails. But there were hundreds of orhawks, their metallic wings reflecting the sun in blinding bursts, and eventually the dragons had no choice but to retreat, heading for the ocean. The orhawks and their riders chased them off amidst cheers from the soldiers below. From the forest came the orcats. Sasha was not amongst them, Gwen noted with pride. Her friend had kept her word and stayed with the young boy. The agile beast slashed through the invaders, ripping out throats and clawing through leather armor. Gwen helped where she could, sending volley after volley of arrows into the enemy, until there were none left standing. The fighting ceased, though orcats continued to prowl amongst the pile of bodies, seeking injured Calypsians to finish off with animalistic fury. One by one, the orhawks and their riders returned, landing atop the high castle walls to provide a warning in case the dragons arrived with reinforcements. The surviving legionnaires searched for survivors, directing Orion healers to those in need. And Gwendolyn searched for Alistair and their fathers. She found her father first. When he saw her, he ran to meet her, one of his arms hanging unnaturally, tucked into his side. Rather than chiding her for disobeying him, he said, "I'm not surprised you came to fight. You are my daughter, after all." She hugged him and he grimaced. "Your arm," she said, searching his flesh for the source of the river of blood cascading down his arm, dripping from his fingertips. "I took a blade through the shoulder. My arm is dead for now, but perhaps the healers can help." Gwen nodded, thankful it wasn't worse. "Have you seen Alistair?" A pained expression slashed across her father's face, sending a ragged bolt of fear through her. "I have not, but his father is dead," he said. "Levi was killed. I'm sorry." Gwen hated herself for the relief she felt in that moment. She'd feared it was Alistair who was dead. Though she could feel the sadness and pain at Alistair's father's death, she was overwhelmed with gratitude that it wasn't her bondmate. She hugged her father again. "Will you help me find Alistair?" "Of course." They searched together, starting at the last place she'd seen him, with the platoon that had been backed against the wall. The bodies were piled three high.
"Alistair!"
she shouted. The silence was deafening. They picked through the bodies for a long while, and Gwendolyn felt her heart stop every time she spotted a face that could be him. She only started breathing again when she determined it was some stranger. Then her father found him.
"Over here," he said.
She ran to him, dropping to her knees beside the man she loved, the man who was still alive, still breathing, though his breaths were ragged, his lips cracked and slick with blood. "It's too late," her father said, placing a hand on her shoulder. Gwen shrugged him off.
"It's not," she snapped. "Healer!"
Alistair raised a finger and pressed it to her lips. That was when she noticed the blood flowing freely from the edges of the armor across his chest. A pool had already collected beneath him.
"I am lucky to have loved one such as you," he said, his voice weak and trembling.
"No,"
Gwen snarled, tears swamping her vision.
"You are not going to die on me. I won't allow it."
Alistair didn't seem to hear her, his eyes distant.
"I was saving this poem for our bonding night," he said.
"Then keep saving it," Gwen said. "I'm not listening. Tell me tonight, when you're bandaged and clean."
"Night's back. Day bright. Stars sparkle. Moonlight."
"Stop!"
Gwen said.
She grabbed his hands, squeezing.
Please, stop. Leaves rustle, streams flow, lightning flashes, winds blow. Please,
she said. But there was no command left in her voice, which had been stripped of all strength.
Gleaming all hawks, a silver dove, so much beauty, but none like you. My love.
She choked out a sob and pressed her head into his chest. His lips were cold on her brow.
Don't go,
she begged.
Don't leave me.
She remembered the night her mother had died, how she'd begged her the same way, how it hadn't made any difference in the end.
It doesn't hurt, Gwendolyn,
Alistair said.
Do not fear for me. I will wait for you in Orion's forest. No, I need you now. I need you here. I will wait.
And then Alistair died.
The sudden Calypsian attack had been coined the Dragon Massacre. Evidently, more than a dozen enemy ships had sailed from Calypso days earlier. They'd not been spotted by Eastern scouts, because they'd travelled in a wide arc, so far offshore as to not be visible from land. By the time they'd made their move back toward shore, on a collision course with Feria, it was too late. Though the Southrunners were defeated, they continued to attack the borders to the south. Gwen's father was killed shortly after in Barrenwood. Several witnesses informed her that it had been Emperor Roan Sands, the famous dragon rider, who had killed him. She cursed his name every night, along with every Calypsian and Phoenician. All told, 10,000 died before the Easterners fought off their enemies. More than 6,000 had perished in the assault on Feria alone, including both Freestep men. Before Gwen's father had departed on his final ride south, he'd told her what Alistair had said to win him over.
"I will love her until the day I die,"
Alistair had promised. And that had been enough for Baroness Storm to give his blessing.
"All I ever wanted was for you to be loved," he'd said, with tears in his eyes.
And then he'd galloped away, never to return. Every day Gwendolyn would place fresh flowers, their petals wet with tears, on the graves of her lost loved ones. Her mother, her father, Arwen, Captain Levi Freestep, and Alistair, her beloved legionnaire poet, her reason for breathing. And each day she vowed never to love anyone as much as him again.
This is the end of the fate-marked postlude novellas, but the story continues with Truth-Marked, Book 2 of the fate-marked epic. Keep listening for a free preview. Part 1. Bane, the beggar, Jai, Rhea, Anise, Raven, Roan, Grey. The warmongers shall resist the flow of destiny, until they are shattered upon sword and shield, sorcery and magic. Truth, in the end, shall reign. The Western Oracle. 1. The Northern Kingdom, Silent Mountain. Bane Gerrick. He was leaving the only home he'd ever known, the little cave high on the western flank of Silent Mountain. Bear Blackboots was long gone, and soon Bane would be, too. He didn't blame the man he'd always known as Father for leaving. There was so much blood on both their hands that sometimes Bane felt as if he was drowning in it, a lake of crimson forcing its way down his throat. He saw the lake in his dreams, too, only it was burning, the waters literally on fire. How it was possible for liquid to burn, he didn't know. When he dreamed about the lake of fire, he could never divert his eyes from the flames, which licked at the bloody lake, an inferno of death and pain and their cries. He could hear them too, his victims screaming. Are they innocent? He wondered to himself. Does it matter? and in his dream he would always be drawn to the lake, to the fire, to the cries. He would stumble down the rocky embankment, pulled forward by an irresistible force. He would pause on the precipice of the shimmering waters for a long, naked moment, the heat of the flames washing over him like a summer wind, and then he would fall. He always awoke before he hit the water, before the fire could touch him, burn him, before those he'd murdered could judge him for his sins. Why, he did not know, but he always felt invigorated afterwards, ready for what was to come next. All he knew was that three rulers were dead. His uncle, King Gil-Loren of the Western Kingdom, King Orin Ironclad, the Juggernaut of the East, and King Wulfric Geric of the Northern Kingdom. His father. What kind of a person kills their own father? He wondered. He shook his head and cast away the pointless question. What he was didn't matter. All that mattered was the Western Oracle's prophecy, the one he was meant to fulfill. His only purpose. Eight rulers shall die in the name of peace. Eight bloody rulers, sent to the lake of fire. Three were dead. Five would follow. Lost in his thoughts, his hand absently touched the flesh of his unnaturally bald scalp, a place where hair had never grown. He could feel the heat of his fate mark pulsating, hotter in the three sections that had already been filled in with blood. He bit his lip and then dropped his hand. He shouldered his pack, which he'd stuffed with provisions, melted snow, smoked meat, extra clothing, a knife, though he wasn't certain he needed such earthly things any more. Bane was going south, and death would quench his thirst and feed him and clothe him. The knife, yes, he would need the knife. Something drew him, a dark energy like his own, which was closing in on one of his prey. No, not something. Someone. I don't have to be alone any more, he thought, and then vanished. 2. The Southern Empire, Calip. The Beggar. He was the plague. The plague was him. Even now, as he stood watching the Empress's cavalcade, he could feel the disease flowing through his blood, humming along his skin, billowing from his mouth with each exhalation. He had killed before.
Oh, mother.
Many times.
Oh, father.
Countless souls devoured by what was in him, the evil that trembled along his pale flesh. The procession thundered past, a long line of horses and the Guanic, the reptilian creatures with clawed feet and mouths full of fangs, their pink tongues hissing between their black lips. Their riders, the Royal Guard, or Guanero, wore dark leather armour bearing the Dragon Rising sigil of the Kingdom of Calip. In the midst of their protectors rode Empress Sun Sands and her trio of daughters, in order of birth, Raven, Fire, and Whisper. The Guanic they rode were the largest of the group, towering above the others, giving the crowd a clear view of their leaders, and their leaders a clear view of the crowd. Empress Sun was like a ray of light, her hair long and blonde, an impressive contrast to her night-dark skin. The juxtaposition was such that her figure appeared to be cut from alternating daggers of sunshine and shadow.
"I am ready,"
the beggar thought. He melted into the crowd, almost vaporous in his movements, like a curling billow of smoke. The Southrons called him many things out of fear, Death's Bastard, Demon Child, and other worse titles. But the name he liked the best was the Beggar.
"That wasn't always your name."
He pushed away the thought, because it was an echo from the past, no longer relevant to today. No, that boy was long gone, fading like mist at first light.
"I am the Beggar."
For that's what he was. He wasn't a beggar in the classic sense. He had no interest in food or water, but a beggar of forgiveness. Because of his tattooia, the mark on his neck, three partial circles, joined in the middle, broken at the edges, most could not really see him. Well, they could see him, but not the real him. To any he happened to meet, they would have little memory of him later, and could only describe him as a smudge of shadow wearing a grey hood. There was one exception to this rule, those who also bore a tattooia. He knew this because once he'd been spotted by one of the Empress's daughters, Fire Sands, the girl who bore the fire mark. Her eyes had zoned in on him like a hawk hunting a field mouse, but he'd managed to slip away into the crowd before she could determine whether he'd been real or just a trick of the hot southern sun. There had been one other, a young man who'd been knocked over by a royal procession, not unlike the one he was watching now, who the beggar had helped to his feet. A young man who he'd killed by accident, touching him with his plague-infected skin through a tear in his glove. A man who surely must have been marked, because he could see him clearly. Rhone, the man had called himself. That man was likely sent to Plague Island, like the rest of the beggar's victims. Sent to die, quarantined from the rest of Calip. There were whisperings that the island had been destroyed by dragons, but those were only rumours, of course. The beggar wondered what power Rhone's tattooia had given him. He also wondered if the poor man had died slowly and painfully, or if he'd found a way to end things quicker. He was snapped out of his morbid reverie when, suddenly, one of the riders cried out. Horses were commanded to halt, and the Guanic, as if by some instinct, skidded to a stop.
"I am ready."
The beggar stepped forward, separating himself from the crowd, which was backing away from the fearsome lizards, which snapped their jaws and clawed in the dirt. Amidst her protectors, a young woman slid lithely from her Guanic's scaly shoulders. Her hair was so dark it was almost blue, plaited down her back where it dangled, snake-like, to her waist. The beggar knew her on sight. She was Raven Sands, eldest daughter of the Empress and first daughter to the Calypsian Empire. An eight-barbed whip dangled from one hand, and she wore a black, sleeveless leather tunic that would have made even the most liberal of Westerners gasp on sight, as well as a short skirt that left little to the imagination. Her exposed skin was brown, not quite as dark as her mother's, smooth, and seemed to go on forever.
"Was she the one who had called out?"
the beggar wondered.
"Sister, why did you stop us?"
Raven asked, looking over her shoulder.
"I could ask the same thing, Fire,"
the Empress said, though she remained mounted. Fire Sands, the second daughter, leapt from her scaly steed, flanking her eldest sister. Fire, like both her sisters, was named in the usual Calypsian manner, her physical attributes linked to the natural world. In the princess's case, her tattooia was a fire mark, it was said, thus her namesake. Her skin was a shade darker than Raven's. Her short hair was like a candle flame atop her scalp, lighting a serious expression. She was scanning the crowd intently, looking for something.
"No," the beggar realized. "Not something. Someone. Me. She's looking for me. That's why she stopped the procession. She caught a glimpse of me."
And, unlike the last time she'd spotted him, he held his ground, even going so far as to take a step forward, then another.
"What am I doing?"
he wondered to himself. It hit him like a sandstone block to the head.
"I want to be caught. I want to be captured. I want to be killed. I am ready."
He was all alone now, a grey island in an ocean of dust. The third daughter swept beside her siblings.
"Can we go, please?"
Whisper Sand said, her voice like wind moving over a desert dune. 4 years Raven's junior, Whisper was small and thin, and wore a white flowing dress that nearly reached the ground, rivaling the length of her chestnut hair, which was so long it could be braided and used as rope. Of the three sisters, her skin was the lightest.
"Wait,"
Fire said, drawing her sword. Flames leapt from her fingers onto the weapon. A sigh of awe rose up from the crowd. The beggar watched with interest. He'd never seen someone with a tattooia use their power. Well, except for himself, and he had little control over the plague, which seemed as wild as a chestful of snakes. The way she flaunted her power captivated him.
"Wait for what?"
Whisper asked.
She can't see me, the beggar thought. Not really. None of them can, save for Fire.
Princesses, a man said, striding in front of the sisters.
He was garbed from head to toe in leather armour marked with the royal sigil, a silver dragon over a rising red sun. The Shiva, the master of order in Calypso. His dark eyes roamed the crowd, passing over the beggar like he didn't even exist.
We cannot tarry here. It's not safe.
I am only following the Empress's orders, Fire said, scanning the crowd once more. The beggar didn't wait for her gaze to settle on him. He stepped forward again. Closer. Closer. He wanted to say something, tried to say something, but his words were swallowed by a sudden wave of emotion that crashed through him. Relief. From there, everything happened quickly. Fire leapt forward, her sword blazing. She kicked him in the stomach, knocking him over. The beggar closed his eyes, waiting for the flames to consume him. He felt nothing. Something was cast over him, thick and warm. He opened his eyes to darkness.
A blanket, he realized.
Voices were there, too, but they were like the sound of individual drops of rain in a thunderstorm, impossible to isolate. Anyway, he didn't care what they had to say about him, not any more. Soon he'd be killed, and then he'd be free.
3. The Southern Empire. Fanes. Jai Jaru. None knew of his mark, and it was better that way. Though those bearing a tattooia were generally revered, almost worshipped, in the southeastern land of Fanes, Jai Jaru knew such adoration wouldn't apply to him. No. Not when his mark went against everything the current Emperor Vin Hosa, the slave master, believed in. Standing in front of Emperor Hosa now, Jai was acutely aware of the mark on his heel. Though it was hidden, he could see it in his mind's eye, the scales of justice gleaming like a lit candle.
"Master Jaru," the Emperor said, "what do you have to report?"
The Emperor stroked his dark moustache and goatee, which reminded Jai of an arrowhead. Hosa's face was powdered with the finest sifted chalk dust, a stark contrast to his black hair. His dark, tight braids were piled atop his head in a honeycomb formation. Tied within his hair and beard were diamonds, sparkling in the natural light streaming through an ornate, beveled windowpane. Gaudy jewelry, rings, adorned all 10 fingers, studded with emeralds, rubies, and diamonds. The wealth on this man's fingers and hair alone could feed all the slaves in Fenia. As if that wasn't enough, the Emperor had jewels sewn into his skin in the typical Phoenician manner. His chest, his arms, even his forehead glittered with 2 lines of jewels, replacing his eyebrows, which had been permanently removed. Vin Hosa sat comfortably in a plush chair, leaning back slightly. Behind him were the great pillars of Fenia, 3 black marble columns so wide around it would take 12 men to surround even one of them. On each was engraved a symbol, representing the 3 great pillars of Fanes, the fist, the sword, the whip. The fist was for brothers, used both to settle disputes and to slap one another on the back when the brawl was over. The sword was for enemies, to cut throats and stab hearts. The whip was for slaves, its lash a constant reminder. The Emperor governed his kingdom by these 3 tenets and no others. Emperor Hosa's eyes generally appeared to be pulled too tight, as if they were incapable of blinking, and yet they did. His mouth was almost always open a sliver, the tip of his pink tongue protruding. Most of his muscular chest was bare, save for a panel of leather secured by 2 straps. The panel was painted with the Phoenician sigil, the 4-eyed lioness. A sleepy spotted python lay curled around Hosa's chair, its long sinuous body so thick that no man would be able to wrap his hands around it. Yet even a python this large was relatively small for the species, which had been known to grow as large as the dragons that patrolled Calip. Living underground in the desert, there were rumors that some red pythons could grow as long as the tallest trees in the tangle. In its sleep, the enormous snake's thin, forked tongue hissed from its mouth intermittently. Several guards stood beside the Emperor at attention, but even they were too far away to be of much use.
I could draw the knife from my belt and plunge it through his heart before—
Jai blinked away the thought, for he knew the Emperor could enslave him with naught but a touch. After all, Vin Hosa bore a tattooia, too. The slave mark. And unlike Jai, he didn't hide his mark. Torches burned all around his chair, illuminating the symbol on his neck and upper chest. Four lengths of iron chain linked in the center. Instead of killing the Emperor, Jai said, "Garadia mine is producing at full capacity. Diamonds flow from the chutes like a river."
Of course they do, Jai thought. Anything less would mean the slaves get whipped, and I cannot allow that.
Good. Increase production by 10%, the Emperor said, waving his hand casually, as if to say, "Now be gone."
Jai didn't move, his jaw set.
"That's impossible," he said through gritted teeth.
He could feel a film of sweat begin to form beneath his own layer of face powder. He knew it was a mistake to question a direct command from Hosa, but he couldn't help himself. Not when the slaves under his command were already so broken. Not when his justice mark flared at the thought of the injustice of their very existence. Jai stood, waiting to be punished for his insolence. To his surprise, however, the slave master only laughed, his tongue flicking out like the spotted pisons.
"Master Giroux, all my life's experience has taught me one thing. Nothing is impossible. Once I would have thought it impossible that my wife, the light of my life, could ever leave me, and yet she did, all for a bunch of dogs."
"The Calypsian Empress, Sun Sands," Jai thought.
When their marriage union was shattered, civil war exploded in the south. A war that had lasted for a dozen years already. Evidently, Empress Sun was against the use of slaves.
"Dogs," as Vin Hosa liked to refer to them as.
The Emperor continued,
"I have great power, and I won't waste it. Not when there is land to be conquered, people to be enslaved, wealth to be obtained. Did you know that there is an attempt on my life every day? Sometimes more than one. And it's not because the people hate me, no, nothing like that. It's because there's a superstition that my power will go to the man," he paused thoughtfully, "or woman, who kills me. You see? Everyone wants what I have. But I won't die easily. And as long as I am emperor, as long as I bear this mark," he gestured to his chest, "I will demand the impossible. And I will get it. Especially now when my enemies are destroying so much of what I've built. The black tears are worse than the Calypsian plague."
Jai had trouble controlling his expression. Over the last few years, the rebel group known as the Black Tears had been gaining in strength and boldness. Twice they'd released slaves from their mines. The first group were caught and killed, and now the mine continued to lie vacant, not producing. The second group, however, had disappeared somewhere along the southernmost tip of the spear. Jai hoped they'd managed to cross the fast-moving river and escape into Calip, but the Emperor was certain they had drowned.
"Lost resources," he called them.
Not much was known of the secretive rebels, except that they were thought to be supporters of Sun Sands before her feud with her husband, and that they etched permanent markings of black tears on their cheeks, each of which were supposedly meant to represent someone they had killed. A death tally, so to speak. Also, according to rumor, every member of the Black Tears was a woman.
"The Black Tears,"
Hosa said again, practically spitting the name out in disgust.
"May they rot in the void."
The Emperor paused again, licking his lips and studying his rings. His gaze traveled sharply back to Jai, and he changed the subject.
"I have heard whispers of your methods as a mine master. They are decidedly unorthodox."
"And yet I get results," Jai said.
He'd had trouble with several of his underlings who didn't agree with his methods. Almost certainly it was one of them who had whispered in the Emperor's ear.
"Some say the slaves are the masters of the mine, rather than you and your comrades,"
Jai didn't like the way this conversation was going, but he remained silent, letting the Emperor choose the course.
"What would you say to your critics?"
Hoza finally asked, when it was clear Jai would not speak. Jai clenched his fists at his sides.
"That results are results, and the means aren't important. My mine is the highest producing in the Empire. Now I know that it's not my slaves who are spreading my secrets, so it must be one of my mine masters. That is unacceptable behavior that must be punished."
The Emperor stared at him with eyes as dark as unlit coals. For a moment, Jai feared he'd been too brazen with his words, that his people would suffer as a result. But then the Emperor laughed again and said,
"Indeed. Insolence must be met with strength. Bring him in."
On command, two bare-chested guards dragged in a man. At first, Jai didn't recognize him. Such was his transformation in appearance. Wearing nothing but a ripped beige sackcloth, the man was a mess of bruises and cuts. His previously long hair had been shorn to the scalp. His eyes wore a vacant, wild expression. His face was without powder for the first time in Jai's recollection, the skin beneath brown with a hint of orange. But the man was Phoenician, not Terran, like most of the slaves.
"Master Axa," Jai thought.
He was one of his most outspoken and violent mine masters. On multiple occasions, Jai had to punish this man for beating one of his workers within an inch of their lives. Jai wasn't surprised it was this snake of a man who'd betrayed him.
"What shall I do with him?"
Hoza asked Jai now.
"Please,"
Axa said, dropping to his knees and knitting his hands together. His narrow eyes locked with Jai's, full of fear and something else, a request for mercy, for forgiveness. In his current state, Axa seemed penitent, and yet he had plenty of his own small jewels sewn into his skin, a reminder of what he once was, what he still represented. Violence, oppression, arrogance, wealth. And yet something about his plea for mercy rang false. Jai's justice mark told him as much. But why would the man lie? Axa really was at Jai's mercy. He considered his options. The Emperor respected swift and harsh punishment, but something told him killing the master would be a mistake. Also, it wasn't the way Jai did things. As usual, when faced with a decision such as this one, his justice mark flared on his heel and provided the answer, as clear as a spoken word in his mind. "Give him to me," he said. "His mind, his body, his soul."
"No,"
Axa breathed. Again, the word itself was false, but Jai didn't have time to consider what that might mean. The Emperor smiled. Jai had chosen wisely.
"As you wish."
The Emperor touched Axa's scalp, and the tattooia on Hoza's chest flared to life, shimmering with red and gold and orange light. Axa screamed and began to shake as a similar marking appeared on his own chest, the chains wrapping around his neck, tightening, releasing, and then settling in. The whites of his eyes turned to darkness, like a sky upon the onset of night. He stopped screaming, stopped shaking, stood stiffly.
"What is your command, master?"
he said to the Emperor. Hoza's lips curled up on one side.
"I give you to Master Jiru, from this day forward until I command otherwise. You will obey his every command. Is this clear?"
"Yes, master."
Though it was what Jai had requested, watching the creation of another slave by the slave master himself twisted his stomach into knots. He hated the dark, glazed look in Axa's eyes, the flat, obedient sound of his voice, the stiffness in his movements. Once more, Hoza flicked his fingers, and this time Jai spun on his heels and departed. Axa trailed behind like a well-trained dog. One of the Emperor's sons was waiting outside, Falcon, the oldest and meanest of the Hoza brood. His scalp was shaved to the skin, save for a long stripe of hair down the center, pressed together to look like a blade. On either side of the mohawk were emeralds sewn into his powdered skin to look like eyes. diamond earrings that likely came from Garadia Mine studded each earlobe. Falcon was known to be a master of Fen Ru, the art of attack, the most popular martial art amongst the Phoenician elite, including most mine masters.